Disc 5.
Chapter 13. Morning activities in Chipping Cleghorn continued. Miss Marple came out of the vicarage gate and walked down the little lane that led to the main street. She walked fairly briskly with the aid of the Reverend Julian Harmon's stout ashplant stick. She passed the Red Cow and the butcher's, and stopped for a brief moment to look into the window of Mr. Elliot's antique shop. This was cunningly situated next door to the Bluebird Tea Rooms and Café, so that rich motorists, after stopping for a nice cup of tea and somewhat euphemistically named homemade cakes of a bright saffron colour, could be tempted by Mr. Elliot's judiciously planned shop window. In this antique bow frame, Mr. Elliot catered for all tastes. Two pieces of Waterford glass reposed on an impeccable wine cooler. A walnut bureau, made up of various bits and pieces, proclaimed itself a genuine bargain, and on a table in the window itself were a nice assortment of cheap door knockers and quaint pixies, a few chipped bits of Dresden, a couple of sad-looking bead necklaces, a mug with a present from Tunbridge Wells on it, and some titbits of Victorian silver. Miss Marple gave the window her rapt attention, and Mr. Elliot, an elderly, obese spider, peeped out of his web to appraise the possibilities of this new fly. But just as he decided that the charms of the present from Tunbridge Wells were about to be too much for the lady who was staying at the vicarage, for of course Mr. Elliot, like everybody else, knew exactly who she was, Miss Marple saw out of the corner of her eye Miss Dora Bunner entering the Bluebird Café, and immediately decided that what she needed to counteract the cold wind was a nice cup of morning coffee. Four or five ladies were already engaged in sweetening their morning shopping by a pause for a refreshment. Miss Marple, blinking a little in the gloom of the interior of the Bluebird and hovering artistically, was greeted by the voice of Dora Bunner at her elbow. "Oh, good morning, Miss Marple. Do sit down here. I'm all alone." "Thank you." Miss Marple subsided gratefully onto the rather angular little blue-painted armchair which the Bluebird affected. "Such a sharp wind," she complained, "and I can't walk very fast because of my rheumatic leg." "Oh, I know. I had sciatica one year, and really most of the time I was in agony." The two ladies talked rheumatism, sciatica, and neuritis for some moments with avidity. A sulky-looking girl in a pink overall with a flight of bluebirds down the front of it took their order for coffee and cakes with a yawn and an air of weary patience. "The cakes," Miss Bunner said in a conspiratorial whisper, "are really quite good here." "I was so interested in that very pretty girl I met as we were coming away from Miss Blacklock's the other day," said Miss Marple. "I think she said she does gardening. Was she on the land? Hines, was that her name?" "Oh, yes, Philippa Hames. Our lodger, as we call her." Miss Bunner laughed at her own humour. "Such a nice, quiet girl. A lady, if you know what I mean. I wonder now. I knew a Colonel Hames in the Indian Cavalry. Her father, perhaps? Oh, she's Mrs. Hames, a widow. Her husband was killed in Sicily or Italy. Of course, it might be his father." "I wondered, perhaps, if there might be a little romance on the way," Miss Marple suggested roguishly, "with that tall young man." "With Patrick, you mean? Oh, I don't know. No, I meant the young man with spectacles. I've seen him about." "Oh, of course, Edmund Swettenham. Shh, shh. That's his mother, Mrs. Swettenham, over in the corner. Well, I don't know, I'm sure. You think he admires her? He's such an odd young man. Says the most disturbing things sometimes. He's supposed to be clever, you know. said Miss Banner with frank disapproval. "Cleverness isn't everything," said Miss Marple, shaking her head. "Ah, here is our coffee." The sulky girl deposited it with a clatter. Miss Marple and Miss Banner pressed cakes on each other. "I was so interested to hear you were at school with Miss Blacklock. Yours is indeed an old friendship." "Yes, indeed," Miss Banner sighed. "Very few people would be as loyal to their old friends as dear Miss Blacklock is. Oh, dear, those days seem a long time ago. Such a pretty girl, and enjoyed life so much. It all seems so sad."
Miss Marple, though with no idea of what had seemed so sad, sighed and shook her head.
"Life is indeed hard," she murmured. "And sad affliction bravely borne," murmured Miss Banner, her eyes suffusing with tears. "I always think of that verse. True patience, true resignation. Such courage and patience ought to be rewarded. That is what I say. What I feel is that nothing is too good for dear Miss Blacklock, and whatever good things come to her, she truly deserves them."
"Money," said Miss Marple, "can do a lot to ease one's path in life." She felt herself safe in this observation, since she judged that it must be Miss Blacklock's prospects of future affluence to which her friend referred. The remark, however, started Miss Banner on another train of thought.
"Money," she exclaimed with bitterness. "I don't believe, you know, that until one has really experienced it, one can know what money, or rather the lack of it, means."
Miss Marple nodded her white head sympathetically. Miss Banner went on rapidly, working herself up and speaking with a flushed face.
"I've heard people say so often, I'd rather have flowers on the table than a meal without them. But how many meals have those people ever missed? They don't know what it is. Nobody knows who hasn't been through it. To be really hungry. Bread, you know, and a jar of meat paste and a scrape of margarine. Day after day, and how one longs for a good plate of meat and two vegetables. And the shabbiness. Darning one's clothes and hoping it won't show. And applying for jobs and always being told you're too old. And then perhaps getting a job, and after all one isn't strong enough. One faints, and you're back again. It's the rent, always the rent, that's got to be paid. Otherwise you're out on the street. And in these days it leaves so little over. One's old age pension doesn't go far, indeed it doesn't."
"I know," said Miss Marple gently. She looked with compassion at Miss Banner's twitching face.
"I wrote to Letty. I just happened to see her name in the paper. It was a luncheon in aid of Milchester Hospital. And there it was in black and white. Miss Letitia Blacklock. It brought the past back to me. I hadn't heard of her for years and years. She'd been a secretary, you know, to that very rich man Girdler. She was always a clever girl. The kind that gets on in the world. Not so much looks as character. I thought, perhaps she'll remember me. And she's one of the people I could ask for a little help. I mean, someone you've known as a girl, been at school with. Well, they do know about you. They know you're not just a begging letter writer."
Tears came into Dora Bunner's eyes.
"And then Lottie came and took me away. She said she needed someone to help her. Of course, I was very surprised, very surprised. But then newspapers do get things wrong. How kind she was, how sympathetic. And remembering all the old days so well, I'd do anything for her. I really would. I try very hard, but I'm afraid sometimes I muddle things. My head's not what it was. I make mistakes and I forget and say foolish things. She's very patient. What's so nice about her is that she always pretends that I am useful to her.
That's real kindness, isn't it?
Miss Marple said gently,
Yes, that's real kindness. I used to worry, you know, even after I came to Little Paddocks, about what would become of me if anything were to happen to Miss Blacklock. After all, there are so many accidents, these motors dashing about. One never knows, does one? But naturally, I never said anything, but she must have guessed. Suddenly, one day, she told me that she'd left me a small annuity in her will, and what I value far more, all her beautiful furniture. I was quite overcome. But she said nobody else would value it as I should. And that is quite true. I can't bear to see some lovely piece of china smashed or wet glasses put down on a table and leaving a mark. I do really look after her things. Some people especially, are so terribly careless, and sometimes worse than careless. I'm not really as stupid as I look, Miss Bunner continued with simplicity. I can see, you know, when let is being imposed upon. But some people, I won't name names, but they take advantage. Dear Miss Blacklock is, perhaps, just a shade too trusting.
Miss Marple shook her head.
Well, that's a mistake. Yes, it is. You and I, Miss Marple, know the world. Dear Miss Blacklock,
she shook her head. Miss Marple thought that as the secretary of a big financier, Miss Blacklock might be presumed to know the world too, but probably what Dora Bunner meant was that Letty Blacklock had always been comfortably off, and that the comfortably off do not know the deeper abysses of human nature.
That Patrick, said Miss Bunner with a suddenness and an asperity that made Miss Marple jump. Twice, at least, to my knowledge, he's got money out of her, pretending he's hard up, run into debt. All that sort of thing. She's far too generous. All she said to me when I remonstrated with her was, the boy's young, Dora. Youth is the time to have your fling.
Well, that's true enough, said Miss Marple. He's such a handsome young man, too.
Handsome is as handsome does, said Dora Bunner, much too fond of poking fun at people, and a lot of going on with girls. I expect I'm just a figure of fun to him, that's all. He doesn't seem to realise that people have their feelings.
Young people are rather careless that way, said Miss Marple. Miss Bunner leaned forward suddenly with a mysterious air.
You won't breathe a word, will you, my dear? She demanded, but I can't help feeling that he was mixed up in this dreadful business. I think he knew that young man, or else Julia did. I daren't hint at such a thing to dear Miss Blacklock. At least I did, and she just snapped my head off. And of course it's awkward, because he's her nephew, or at any rate her cousin. And if the Swiss young man shot himself, Patrick might be held morally responsible, mightn't he? If he'd put him up to it, I mean. I'm really terribly confused about the whole thing. Everyone making such a fuss about that other door into the drawing room. That's another thing that worries me. The detective saying it had been oiled. Because, you see, I saw...
She came to an abrupt stop. Miss Marple paused to select a phrase.
It's most difficult for you, she said sympathetically. Naturally, you wouldn't want anything to get round to the police. That's just it, Dora Bunner cried. I lie awake at nights and worry. Because, you see, I came upon Patrick in the shrubbery the other day. I was looking for eggs. One hen lays out, and there he was, holding a feather and a cup, an oily cup. And he jumped most guiltily when he saw me, and he said, I was just wondering what this was doing here. Well, of course, he's a quick thinker. I should say he thought that up quickly when I startled him. And how did he come to find a thing like that in the shrubbery, unless he was looking for it, knowing perfectly well it was there?
Well, of course, I didn't say anything. Oh, no, no, of course not. But I gave him a look, if you know what I mean.
Dora Bunner stretched out her hand and bit abstractedly into a lurid salmon-coloured cake.
And then the other day, I happened to overhear him having that very curious conversation with Julia. They seemed to be having a kind of quarrel. He was saying, if I thought you had anything to do with a thing like that, and Julia, she's always so calm, you know, said, well, little brother, what would you do about it? And then, most unfortunately, I trod on that board that always squeaks and they saw me. So I said, quite gaily, you two having a quarrel? And Patrick said, I'm warning Julia not to go in for these black market deals. Oh, it was all very slick. But I don't believe they were talking about anything of the sort. And if you ask me, I believe Patrick had tampered with that lamp in the drawing room to make the lights go out, because I remember distinctly that it was the shepherdess, not the shepherd. And the next day, she stopped, and her face grew pink.
Miss Marple turned her head to see Miss Blacklock standing behind them. She must have just come in. "Coffee and gossip, Bunny," said Miss Blacklock, with quite a shade of reproach in her voice. "Good morning, Miss Marple. Cold, isn't it?"
"We were just talking," said Miss Bunner hurriedly. "So many rules and regulations nowadays, one really doesn't know where one is."
The doors flew open with a clang, and Bunch Harmon came into the Bluebird with a rush.
"Hello," she said. "Am I too late for coffee?"
"No, dear," said Miss Marple.
"Sit down and have a cup." "We must get home," said Miss Blacklock. "Done your shopping, Bunny?" Her tone was indulgent once more, but her eyes still held a slight reproach.
Yes, yes, thank you, Letty. I must just pop into the chemist's in passing and get some aspirin and some corn plasters.
As the doors of the Bluebird swung to behind them, Bunch asked, "What are you talking about?" Miss Marple did not reply at once. She waited whilst Bunch gave the order. Then she said,
"Family solidarity is a very strong thing, very strong. Do you remember some famous case? I really can't remember what it was. They said the husband poisoned his wife in a glass of wine. Then, at the trial, the daughter said she'd drunk half her mother's glass. So that knocked the case against her father to pieces. They do say, but that may be just rumour, that she never spoke to her father or lived with him again. Of course, a father is one thing, and a nephew or a distant cousin is another. But still, there it is. No one wants a member of their own family hanged, do they?"
"No," said Bunch, considering. "I shouldn't think they would." Miss Marple leaned back in her chair. She murmured under her breath,
"People are really very alike everywhere."
"Who am I like?"
"Well, really, dear, you are very much like yourself. I don't know that you remind me of anyone in particular, except perhaps..."
"Here it comes," said Bunch.
"I was just thinking of a parlourmaid of mine, dear."
"A parlourmaid? I should make a terrible parlourmaid."
"Yes, dear, so did she. She was no good at all at waiting at table. Put everything on the table crooked, mixed up the kitchen knives with the dining-room ones, and her cap... Oh, this was a long time ago, dear. Her cap was never straight."
Bunch adjusted her hat automatically.
"Anything else?" she demanded anxiously. "I kept her because she was so pleasant to have about the house, and because she used to make me laugh. I liked the way she said things straight out. Came to me one day. 'Of course I don't know, ma'am,' she says, 'but Florrie, the way she sits down, it's just like a married woman.' And, sure enough, poor Florrie was in trouble. The gentlemanly assistant at the hairdresser's... Fortunately, it was in good time, and I was able to have a little talk with him, and they had a very nice wedding, and settled down quite happily. She was a good girl, Florrie, but inclined to be taken in by a gentlemanly appearance.
"She didn't do a murder, did she?" asked Punch. "The parlourmaid, I mean."
"Oh, no, indeed," said Miss Marple. "She married a Baptist minister, and they had a family of five."
"Oh, just like me," said Bunch, "though I've only got as far as Edward and Susan up to date." She added, after a minute or two, "Who are you thinking about now, Aunt Jane?"
"Quite a lot of people, dear, quite a lot of people," said Miss Marple vaguely.
"In St. Mary Mead?"
Mostly. "I was really thinking about Nurse Ellerton. Really an excellent, kindly woman. Took care of an old lady, seemed really fond of her. Then the old lady died. And another came, and she died. Morphia. It all came out. Done in the kindest way. And the shocking thing was that the woman herself really couldn't see that she'd done anything wrong. They hadn't long to live in any case, she said, and one of them had cancer and quite a lot of pain."
"You mean it was a mercy killing?"
"No, no. They signed their money away to her. She liked money, you know. And then there was that young man on the liner. Mrs. Pusey at the paper shop, her nephew. Brought home stuff he'd stolen and got her to dispose of it. Said it was things that he'd bought abroad. She was quite taken in. And then when the police came round and started asking questions, he tried to bash her on the head so that she shouldn't be able to give him away. Not a nice young man, but very good-looking. He had two girls in love with him. He spent a lot of money on one of them."
"The nastiest one, I suppose," said Bunch.
"Yes, dear. And there was Mrs. Cray at the wool shop. Devoted to her son. Spoiled him, of course. He got in with a very queer lot. Do you remember Joan Croft, Punch?"
"No, I don't think so."
"I thought you might have seen her when you were with me on a visit. Used to talk about smoking a cigar or a pipe. We had a bank hold-up once, and Joan Croft was in the bank at the time. She knocked the man down and took his revolver away from him. She was congratulated on her courage by the bench."
Bunch listened attentively. She seemed to be learning by heart.
"And," she prompted, "that girl at Saint-Jean-des-Collines that summer. Such a quiet girl. Well, not so much quiet as silent. Everybody liked her, but they never got to know her much better. And we heard afterwards that her husband was a forger. It made her feel cut off from people. It made her, in the end, a little queer. Brooding does, you know."
"Any Anglo-Indian colonels in your reminiscences, darling?"
"Naturally, dear. There was Major Vaughan at the Larches, and Colonel Wright at Simla Lodge. Nothing wrong with either of them. But I do remember Mr. Hodgson, the bank manager, went on a cruise and married a woman young enough to be his daughter. No idea of where she came from. Except what she told him, of course."
"And that wasn't true?"
"No, dear, it definitely wasn't."
"Not bad," said Bunch, nodding and ticking people off on her fingers. "We've had devoted Dora, and handsome Patrick, and Mrs. Swettenham and Edmund, and Philippa Hames, and Colonel Easterbrook and Mrs. Easterbrook. And if you ask me, I should say you're absolutely right about her. But there wouldn't be any reason for her murdering Letty Blacklock."
"Miss Blacklock, of course, might know something about her that she didn't want known."
"Oh, darling, that old Tanqueray stuff, surely that's dead as the hills."
"It might not be. You see, Bunch, you are not the kind that minds much about what people think of you."
"I see what you mean," said Bunch suddenly. "If you'd been up against it, and then, rather like a shivering stray cat, you'd found a home and a cream and a warm, stroking hand, and you were called Pretty Pussy, and somebody thought the world of you, you'd do a lot to keep that."
"Well, I must say, you've presented me with a very complete gallery of people."
"You didn't get them all right, you know," said Miss Marple mildly.
"Didn't I? Where did I slip up? Julia?
Julia, pretty. Julia is peculiar."
3 and 6 months, said the sulky waitress, materializing out of the gloom.
"And," she added, her bosom heaving beneath the blue birds, "I'd like to know, Mrs. Harmon, why you call me peculiar. I had an aunt who joined the peculiar people, but I've always been good Church of England myself, as the late Reverend Hopkinson can tell you."
"Well, I'm terribly sorry," said Bunge. "I was just quoting a song. I didn't mean you at all. I didn't know your name was Julia."
"Quite a coincidence," said the sulky waitress, cheering up. "Well, no offence, I'm sure, but hearing my name as I thought, well, naturally, if you think someone's talking about you, it's only human nature to listen."
"Thank you."
She departed with her tip.
"Aunt Jane," said Bunge, "don't look so upset. What is it?"
"But surely," murmured Miss Marple, "that couldn't be so. There's no reason."
"Aunt Jane!"
Miss Marple sighed and then smiled brightly.
"It's nothing, dear," she said.
"Did you think you knew who did the murder?" asked Bunch. "Who was it?"
"I don't know at all," said Miss Marple. "I got an idea for a moment, but it's gone. I wish I did know. Time's so short. So terribly short."
"What do you mean, short?"
"That old lady up in Scotland may die any moment."
Bunge said, staring,
"Then you really do believe in Pip and Emma? You think it was them? And that they'll try again?"
"Of course they'll try again," said Miss Marple, almost absent-mindedly. "If they tried once, they'll try again. If you've made up your mind to murder someone, you don't stop because the first time it didn't come off. Especially if you're fairly sure you're not suspected."
"But if it's Pip and Emma," said Bunge, "there are only 2 people it could be. It must be Patrick and Julia. They're brother and sister, and they're the only ones who are the right age."
"My dear, it isn't nearly as simple as that. There are all sorts of ramifications and combinations. There's Pip's wife, if he's married, or Emma's husband. There's their mother. She's an interested party, even if she doesn't inherit direct. If Letty Blacklock hasn't seen her for 30 years, she'd probably not recognise her now. One elderly woman is very like another. You remember, Mrs. Wotherspoon drew her own and Mrs. Bartlett's old-age pension, although Mrs. Bartlett had been dead for years. Anyway, Miss Blacklock's short-sighted. Haven't you noticed how she peers at people? And then there's the father. Apparently he was a real bad lot."
"Yes, but he's a foreigner."
"By birth. But there's no reason to believe he speaks broken English and gesticulates with his hands. I dare say he could play the part of an Anglo-Indian colonel as well as anybody else."
"Is that what you think?"
"No, I don't. I don't indeed, dear. I just think that there's a great deal of money at stake. A great deal of money. And I'm afraid I know only too well the really terrible things that people will do to lay their hands on a lot of money."
"I suppose they will," said Bunge. "It doesn't really do them any good, does it? Not in the end."
"No. But they don't usually know that."
"I can understand it," Bunge smiled suddenly, her sweet, rather crooked smile. "One feels it would be different for oneself. Even I feel that." She considered. "You pretend to yourself that you do a lot of good with all that money. Schemes, homes for unwanted children, tired mothers, a lovely rest abroad somewhere for some elderly women who have worked too hard." Her face grew sombre. Her eyes were suddenly dark and tragic.
"I know what you're thinking," she said to Miss Marple. You're thinking that I'd be the worst kind, because I'd kid myself. If you just wanted the money for selfish reasons, you'd at any rate see what you were like. But once you began to pretend about doing good with it, you'd be able to persuade yourself, perhaps, that it wouldn't very much matter killing someone. Then her eyes cleared. "But I shouldn't," she said. "I shouldn't really kill anyone. Not even if they were old or ill or doing a lot of harm in the world. Not even if they were blackmailers or absolute beasts." She fished a fly carefully out of the dregs of the coffee and arranged it on the table to dry. "Because people like living, don't they? So do flies. Even if you're old and in pain, and you can just crawl out in the sun. Julian says those people like living even more than young, strong people do. It's harder, he says, for them to die. The struggle's greater. I like living myself. Not just being happy and enjoying myself and having a good time. I mean, living. Waking up and feeling all over me that I'm there. Ticking over." She blew on the fly gently. It waved its legs and flew rather drunkenly away. "Cheer up, darling Aunt Jane," said Bunge. "I'd never kill anybody." Chapter 14. Excursion into the Past. After a night in the train, Inspector Craddock alighted at a small station in the Highlands. It struck him for a moment as strange that the wealthy Mrs. Girdler, an invalid, with a choice of a London house in a fashionable square, an estate in Hampshire, and a villa in the south of France, should have selected this remote Scottish home as her residence. Surely she was cut off here from many friends and distractions. It must be a lonely life. Or was she too ill to notice or care about her surroundings? A car was waiting to meet him, a big old-fashioned Daimler with an elderly chauffeur driving it. It was a sunny morning, and the inspector enjoyed the 20-mile drive, though he marvelled anew at this preference for isolation. A tentative remark to the chauffeur brought partial enlightenment. "It's her own home as a gal. She's the last of the family. And she and Mr. Girdler were always happier here than anywhere, though it wasn't often he could get away from London. But when he did, they enjoyed themselves like a couple of bairns." When the grey walls of the old keep came in sight, Craddock felt that time was slipping backwards. An elderly butler received him, and after a wash and a shave, he was shown into a room with a huge fire burning in the grate, and breakfast was served to him. After breakfast, a tall, middle-aged woman, in nurse's dress, with a pleasant and competent manner, came in and introduced herself as Sister McClelland. "I have my patient all ready for you, Mr. Craddock. She is indeed looking forward to seeing you." "I'll do my best not to excite her," Craddock promised. "I had better warn you of what will happen. You will find Mrs. Girdler apparently quite normal. She will talk and enjoy talking, and then, quite suddenly, her powers will fail. Come away at once, then, and send for me. She is, you see, kept almost entirely under the influence of morphia. She drowses most of the time. In preparation for your visit, I've given her a strong stimulant. As soon as the effect of the stimulant wears off, she will relapse into semi-consciousness." "I quite understand, Miss McClelland. Would it be in order for you to tell me exactly what the state of Mrs. Girdler's health is?" "Well, Mr. Craddock, she is a dying woman. Her life cannot be prolonged for more than a few weeks. To say that she should have been dead years ago would strike you as odd, yet it is the truth. What has kept Mrs. Girdler alive is her intense enjoyment and love of being alive. That sounds perhaps an odd thing to say of someone who has lived the life of an invalid for many years and has not left her home here for 15 years, but it is true. Mrs. Gadler has never been a strong woman, but she has retained to an astonishing degree the will to live. She added with a smile, "She's a very charming woman, too, as you will find." Craddock was shown into a large bedroom where a fire was burning and where an old lady lay in a large canopied bed. Though she was only about 7 or 8 years older than Letitia Blacklock, her fragility made her seem older than her years. Her white hair was carefully arranged. A froth of pale blue wool enveloped her neck and shoulders. There were lines of pain on the face, but lines of sweetness too. And there was, strangely enough, what Craddock could only describe as a roguish twinkle in her faded blue eyes. "Well, this is interesting," she said. "It's not often I receive a visit from the police. I hear Letitia Blacklock wasn't much hurt by this attempt on her. How is my dear Blackie?" "She's very well, Mrs. Girdler. She sent you her love."
"Oh, it's a long time since I've seen her. For many years now, it's been just a card at Christmas. I asked her to come up here when she came back to England after Charlotte's death, but she said it would be painful after so long. And perhaps she was right.
Blackie always had a lot of sense. I had an old school friend to see me about a year ago, and law," she smiled, "we bored each other to death. After we'd finished all the do you remembers, there wasn't anything to say. It was most embarrassing."
Craddock was content to let her talk before pressing his questions. He wanted, as it were, to get back into the past, to get the feel of the Girdler-Blacklock ménage.
"I suppose," said Bell shrewdly, "that you want to ask about the money? Randall left it all to go to Blackie after my death. Really, of course, Randall never dreamed that I'd outlive him. He was a big, strong man, never a day's illness, and I was always a mass of aches and pains and complaints and doctors coming and pulling long faces over me." "I don't think complaints would be the right word, Mrs. Girdler." The old lady chuckled. "Why, I didn't mean it in the complaining sense. I've never been too sorry for myself. But it was always taken for granted that I, being the weakly one, would go first. It didn't work out that way. No, it didn't work out that way."
Why exactly did your husband leave his money the way he did?"
"You mean, why did he leave it to Blackie?"
"Well, not for the reason you've probably been thinking." The roguish twinkle was very apparent. "What minds you policemen have. Randall was never in the least in love with her, and she wasn't with him. Letitia, you know, has really got a man's mind. She hasn't any feminine feelings or weaknesses. I don't believe she was ever in love with any man. She was never particularly pretty, and she didn't care for clothes. She used a little make-up in deference to prevailing custom, but not to make herself look prettier." There was pity in the old voice as she went on. "She never knew any of the fun of being a woman." Craddock looked at the frail little figure in the big bed with interest. Belle Girdler, he realized, had enjoyed, still enjoyed, being a woman. She twinkled at him. "I've always thought," she said, "it must be terribly dull to be a man." Then she said thoughtfully, "I think Randall looked on Blackie very much as a kind of younger brother. He relied on her judgment, which was always excellent. She kept him out of trouble more than once, you know. She told me that she came to his rescue once with money."
"That, yes. But I meant more than that. One can speak the truth after all these years. Randall couldn't really distinguish between what was crooked and what wasn't. His conscience wasn't sensitive. The poor dear really didn't know what was just smart and what was dishonest. Blackie kept him straight. That's one thing about Letitia Blacklock. She's absolutely dead straight. She would never do anything that was dishonest. She's a very fine character, you know. I've always admired her. They had a terrible girlhood, those girls. The father was an old country doctor, terrifically pig-headed and narrow-minded, the complete family tyrant. Letitia broke away, came to London, and trained herself as a chartered accountant. The other sister was an invalid. There was a deformity of kinds, and she never saw people or went out. That's why when the old man died, Letitia gave up everything to go home and look after her sister. Randall was wild with her, but it made no difference. If Letitia thought a thing was her duty, she'd do it, and you couldn't move her. How long was that before your husband died? Oh, a couple of years, I think. Randall made his will before she left the firm, and he didn't alter it. He said to me, "We've no one of our own. Our little boy died, you know, when he was 2 years old. After you and I are gone, Blackie had better have the money. She'll play the markets and make 'em sit up." You see, Belle went on, Randall enjoyed the whole money-making game so much. It wasn't just the money. It was the adventure, the risks, the excitement of it all. And Blackie liked it too. She had the same adventurous spirit and the same judgment. Poor darling. She'd never had any of the usual fun. Being in love, and leading men on, and teasing them, and having a home, and children, and all the real fun of life. Craddock thought it was odd. The real pity and indulgent contempt felt by this woman, a woman whose life had been hampered by illness, whose only child had died, whose husband had died, leaving her to a lonely widowhood, and who had been a hopeless invalid for years. She nodded her head at him. "I know what you're thinking. But I've had all the things that make life worthwhile. They may have been taken from me, but I have had them. I was pretty and gay as a girl. I married the man I loved, and he never stopped loving me. My child died, but I had him for 2 precious years. I've had a lot of physical pain. But if you have pain, you know how to enjoy the exquisite pleasure of the times when pain stops. And everyone's been kind to me, always. I'm a lucky woman, really." Craddock seized upon an opening in her former remarks. "You said just now, Mrs. Girdler, that your husband left his fortune to Miss Blacklock because he had no one else to leave it to? But that's not strictly true, is it? He had a sister." "Oh, Sonia. But they quarrelled years ago and made a clean break of it."
"He disapproved of her marriage?"
"Yes. She married a man called, now, what was his name?
Stamfordes?"
"That's it. Dimitri Stamfordes. Randall always said he was a crook. The two men didn't like each other from the first. But Sonia was wildly in love with him and quite determined to marry him. And I really never saw why she shouldn't. Men have such odd ideas about these things. Sonia wasn't a mere girl. She was 25. She knew exactly what she was doing. He was a crook, I dare say. I mean, really, a crook. I believe he had a criminal record, and Randall always suspected the name he was passing under here wasn't his own. Sonia knew all that. The point was, which of course Randall couldn't appreciate, that Dmitri was really a wildly attractive person to women. And he was just as much in love with Sonia as she was with him. Randall insisted that he was just marrying her for her money, but that wasn't true. Sonia was very handsome, you know, and she had plenty of spirit. If the marriage had turned out badly, if Dmitri had been unkind to her or unfaithful to her, she would just have cut her losses and walked out on him. She was a rich woman and could do as she chose with her life. The quarrel was never made up. No. Randall and Sonia never had got on very well. She resented his trying to prevent the marriage. She said, "Very well, you're quite impossible. This is the last you hear of me." "But it was not the last you heard of her." Belle smiled. "No. I got a letter from her about 18 months afterwards. She wrote from Budapest, I remember, but she didn't give an address. She told me to tell Randall that she was extremely happy and that she just had twins."
"And she told you their names?"
Again Belle smiled. "She said they were born just after midday, and she intended to call them Pip and Emma. That may have been just a joke, of course."
"Didn't you hear from her again?"
"No. She said she and her husband and the babies were going to America on a short stay. I never heard any more."
"You don't happen, I suppose, to have kept that letter?"
"No, I'm afraid not. I read it to Randall, and he just grunted, 'She'll regret marrying that fellow one of these days.' That's all he ever said about it. We really forgot about her. She went right out of our lives."
"Nevertheless, Mr. Girdler left his estate to her children in the event of Miss Blacklock predeceasing you."
"Oh, that was my doing. I said to him when he told me about the will, 'And suppose Blackie dies before I do?' He was quite surprised. I said, 'Oh, I know Blackie is as strong as a horse, and I'm a delicate creature, but there's such a thing as accidents, you know, and there's such a thing as creaking gates.' And he said, 'There's no one, absolutely no one.' I said, 'There's Sonia.' And he said at once, 'And let that fellow get hold of my money?' 'No, indeed.' I said, 'Well, her children, then, Pip and Emma, and there may be lots more by now.' And so he grumbled, but he did put it in."
"And from that day to this," Craddock said slowly, "you've heard nothing of your sister-in-law or her children?"
"Nothing. They may be dead. They may be anywhere. They may be in Chipping Cleghorn," thought Craddock. As though she read his thoughts, a look of alarm came into Belle Girdler's eyes. She said, Don't let them hurt Blackie. Blackie's good, really good. You mustn't let harm come to—" Her voice trailed off suddenly. Craddock saw the sudden grey shadows round her mouth and eyes.
"You're tired," he said. "I'll go." She nodded.
"Send Mac to me," she whispered. "He's tired."
She made a feeble motion of her hand.
Look after Blackie. Nothing must happen to Blackie. Look after her."
"I'll do my very best, Mrs. Girdler." He rose and went to the door. Her voice, a thin thread of sound, followed him.
"It's not long now until I'm dead. It's dangerous for her. Take care."
Sister McClelland passed him as he went out. He said uneasily, "I hope I haven't done her harm." "Oh, I don't think so, Mr. Craddock. I told you she would tire quite suddenly." Later, he asked the nurse, "The only thing I hadn't time to ask Mrs. Girdler was whether she had any old photographs. If so, I wonder..." She interrupted him. "I'm afraid there's nothing of that kind. All her personal papers and things were stored with their furniture from the London house at the beginning of the war. Mrs. Girdler was desperately ill at the time. Then the storage depository was blitzed. Mrs. Girdler was very upset at losing so many personal souvenirs and family papers. I'm afraid there's nothing of that kind." So that was that, Craddock thought. Yet he felt his journey had not been in vain. Pip and Emma, those twin wraiths, were not quite wraiths. Craddock thought, here's a brother and sister brought up somewhere in Europe. Sonia Girdler was a rich woman at the time of her marriage, but money in Europe hasn't remained money. Queer things have happened to money during these war years. And so there are two young people, the son and daughter of a man who had a criminal record. Suppose they came to England more or less penniless, what would they do? Find out about any rich relatives. Their uncle, a man of vast fortune, is dead. Possibly the first thing they'd do would be to look up that uncle's will, see if by any chance money had been left to them or to their mother. So, they go to Somerset House and learn the contents of his will, and then, perhaps, they learn of the existence of Miss Letitia Blacklock. Then they make inquiries about Randall Girdler's widow. She's an invalid, living up in Scotland, and they find out she hasn't long to live. If this Letitia Blacklock dies before her, they will come into a vast fortune. What then? Craddock thought, they wouldn't go to Scotland. They'd find out where Letitia Blacklock is living now. And they'd go there, but not as themselves. They'd go together or separately. Emma, I wonder... Pip and Emma. I'll eat my hat if Pip or Emma or both of them aren't in Chipping Cleghorn now. Chapter 15. Delicious Death. In the kitchen at Little Paddock's, Miss Blacklock was giving instructions to Mitzi. Sardine sandwiches as well as the tomato ones, and some of those little scones you make so nicely, and I'd like you to make that special cake of yours. Is it a party, then, that you want all these things? It's Miss Bunner's birthday, and some people will be coming to tea. At her age, one does not have birthdays. It is better to forget. Well, she doesn't want to forget. Several people are bringing her presents, and it'll be nice to make a little party of it. That is what you say last time. And see what happened. Miss Blacklock controlled her temper. Well, it won't happen this time. How do you know what may happen in this house? All day long I shiver, and at night I lock my door, and I look in the wardrobe to see no one is hidden there. That ought to keep you nice and safe, said Miss Blacklock coldly. The cake that you want me to make, it is the... Mitzi uttered a sound that to Miss Blacklock's English ear sounded like Schwitzebritz, or alternatively like cats spitting at each other. That's the one, the rich one. Yes, it is rich. For it I have nothing. Impossible to make such a cake. I need for it chocolate and much butter and sugar and raisins. You can use this tin of butter that was sent us from America, and some of the raisins we were keeping for Christmas, and here is a slab of chocolate and a pound of sugar. Mitzi's face suddenly burst into radiant smiles. So, I make him for you good. Good, she cried in an ecstasy. It will be rich, rich, of a melting richness. And on top, I will put the icing, chocolate icing.
and make him so nice, and write on it, good wishes. These English people with their cakes that tastes of sand, never, never will they have tasted such a cake. Delicious, they will say. Delicious. Her face clouded again. Mr. Patrick, he called it delicious death. My cake, I will not have my cake called that.
It was a compliment, really, said Miss Blacklock. He meant it was worth dying to eat such a cake.
Mitzi looked at her doubtfully. Well, I do not like that word, death. They are not dying because they eat my cake, no. They feel much better.
I'm sure we all shall. Miss Blacklock turned away and left the kitchen with a sigh of relief at the successful ending of the interview. With Mitzi, one never knew. She ran into Dora Bunner outside.
Oh, Letty, shall I run in and tell Mitzi just how to cut the sandwiches?
No, said Miss Blacklock, steering her friend firmly into the hall. She's in a good mood now, and I don't want her disturbed.
But I could just show her...
Please, don't show her anything, Dora. These Central Europeans don't like being shown. They hate it. Dora looked at her doubtfully. Then she suddenly broke into smiles.
Edmund Swettenham just rang up. He wished me many happy returns of the day and said he was bringing me a pot of honey as a present this afternoon. Isn't it kind? I can't imagine how he knew it was my birthday.
Everybody seems to know. You must have been talking about it, Dora.
Well, I did just happen to mention that today I should be 59.
You're 64, said Miss Blacklock with a twinkle.
And Miss Hinchcliffe said, you don't look it. What age do you think I am? Which was rather awkward, because Miss Hinchcliffe always looks so peculiar that she might be any age. She said she was bringing me some eggs, by the way. I said our hens haven't been laying very well lately.
We're not doing so badly out of your birthday, said Miss Blacklock. Honey, eggs, a magnificent box of chocolates from Julia.
I don't know where she gets such things.
Better not ask. Her methods are probably strictly illegal.
And your lovely brooch.
Miss Bunner looked down proudly at her bosom, on which was pinned a small diamond leaf. Do you like it? I'm glad. I never cared for jewellery.
I love it.
Good. Let's go and feed the ducks. Ha! Cried Patrick dramatically, as the party took their places round the dining-room table. What do I see before me? Delicious death.
Hush, said Miss Blacklock. Don't let Mitzi hear you. She objects to your name for her cake very much.
Nevertheless, delicious death it is. Is it Bunny's birthday cake?
Yes, it is, said Miss Bunner. I really am having the most wonderful birthday.
Her cheeks were flushed with excitement, and had been ever since Colonel Easterbrook had handed her a small box of sweets and declaimed with a bow.
Sweets to the sweet.
Julia had turned her head away hurriedly and had been frowned at by Miss Blacklock. Full justice was done to the good things on the tea table, and they rose from their seats after a round of crackers.
Well, I feel slightly sick, said Julia.
It's that cake. I remember I felt just the same last time.
It's worth it, said Patrick.
These foreigners certainly understand confectionery, said Miss Hinchcliffe. What they can't make is a plain boiled pudding. Everybody was respectfully silent, though it seemed to be hovering on Patrick's lips to ask if anyone really wanted a plain boiled pudding.
Got a new gardener?
Asked Miss Hinchcliffe of Miss Blacklock as they returned to the drawing-room.
No, why? Saw a man snooping round the hen-house. Quite a decent-looking army type.
Oh, that, said Julia. That's our detective. Mrs. Easterbrook dropped her handbag.
Detective? She exclaimed. But why?
I don't know, said Julia. He prowls about and keeps an eye on the house. He's protecting Aunt Letty, I suppose.
Absolute nonsense, said Miss Blacklock. I can protect myself, thank you.
But surely it's all over now, cried Mrs. Easterbrook.
though I meant to ask you, why did they adjourn the inquest?
Police aren't satisfied, said her husband. That's what that means.
But aren't satisfied of what?
Colonel Easterbrook shook his head with the air of a man who could say a good deal more if he chose. Edmund, who disliked the Colonel, said, The truth of it is, we're all under suspicion.
But suspicion of what? Repeated Mrs. Easterbrook.
Never mind, kitten, said her husband.
Loitering with intent, said Edmund. The intent being to commit murder upon the first opportunity.
Oh, don't, please don't, Mr. Swettenham. Dora Bunner began to cry. I'm sure nobody here could possibly want to kill dear Letty.
There was a moment of horrible embarrassment. Edmund turned scarlet and murmured, It's just a joke. Philippa suggested in a high, clear voice that they might listen to the 6 o'clock news, and the suggestion was received with enthusiastic assent. Patrick murmured to Julia, We need Mrs. Harmon here. She'd be sure to say in that high, clear voice of hers, But I suppose somebody is still waiting for a good chance to murder you, Miss Blacklock. I'm glad she and that old Miss Marple couldn't come, said Julia. That old woman is the prying kind, and a mind like a sink, I should think, real Victorian type. Listening to the news led easily into a pleasant discussion on the horrors of atomic warfare. Colonel Easterbrook said that the real menace to civilization was undoubtedly Russia, and Edmund said that he had several charming Russian friends, which announcement was coldly received. The party broke up with renewed thanks to the hostess. "Enjoy yourself, Bunny?" asked Miss Blacklock as the last guest was sped.
"Oh, I did. But I've got a terrible headache. It's the excitement, I think."
"It's the cake," said Patrick. "I feel a bit liverish myself. And you've been nibbling chocolates all the morning."
I'll go and lie down, I think," said Miss Bunner. "I'll take a couple of aspirins and try and have a nice sleep."
"That would be a very good plan," said Miss Blacklock. Miss Bunner departed upstairs. "Shall I shut up the ducks for you, Aunt Letty?" Miss Blacklock looked at Patrick severely. "If you'll be sure to latch that door properly."
"I will, I swear I will."
"Have a glass of sherry, Aunt Letty," said Julia. "As my old nurse used to say, it'll settle your stomach." A revolting phrase, but curiously apposite at this moment. "Well, I dare say it might be a good thing. The truth is, one isn't used to rich things." "Oh, Bunny, how you made me jump. What is it?"
"I can't find my aspirin," said Miss Bunner disconsolately.
"Well, take some of mine, dear. They're by my bed." "There's a bottle on my dressing table," said Philippa.
"Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. If I can't find mine, but I know I've got it somewhere. It's a new bottle. Now, where could I have put it?"
"There's heaps in the bathroom," said Julia impatiently. "This house is chock full of aspirin."
"Well, it vexes me to be so careless and mislay things," replied Miss Bunner, retreating up the stairs again.
"Poor old Bunny," said Julia, holding up her glass. "Do you think we ought to have given her some sherry?" "Better not, I think," said Miss Blacklock. "She had a lot of excitement today, and it isn't really good for her. I'm afraid she'll be the worse for it tomorrow. Still, I really do think she has enjoyed herself."
"She's loved it," said Philippa.
"Let's give Mitzi a glass of sherry," suggested Julia.
"Hi, Pat," she called as she heard him entering the side door. "Fetch Mitzi." So Mitzi was brought in, and Julia poured her out a glass of sherry.
"Here's to the best cook in the world," said Patrick.
Mitzi was gratified, but felt, nevertheless, that a protest was due.
"That is not so. I am not really a cook. In my country, I do intellectual work."
"Then you're wasted," said Patrick. "What's intellectual work compared to a chef d'oeuvre like Delicious Death?"
Oh, I say to you, I do not like.
Never mind what you like, my girl, said Patrick. That's my name for it, and here's to it. Let's all drink to delicious death and to hell with the after effects.
Philippa, my dear, I want to talk to you.
Yes, Miss Blacklock? Philippa Hames looked up in slight surprise.
You're not worrying about anything, are you?
Worrying?
I've noticed that you've looked worried lately. There isn't anything wrong, is there?
Oh, no, Miss Blacklock. What should there be?
Well, I wondered. I thought perhaps that you and Patrick...
Patrick? Philippa looked really surprised.
It's not so, then. Well, please forgive me if I've been impertinent. But you've been thrown together a lot, and although Patrick is my cousin, I don't think he's the type to make a satisfactory husband. Not for some time to come, at all events.
Philippa's face had frozen into a hard immobility. I shan't marry again, she said.
Oh, yes, you will some day, my child. You're young. But we needn't discuss that. There's no other trouble? You're not worried about money, for instance?
No, I'm quite all right.
I know you get anxious sometimes about your boy's education. That's why I want to tell you something. I drove into Milchester this afternoon to see Mr. Bedingfield, my lawyer. Things haven't been very settled lately, and I thought I would like to make a new will in view of certain eventualities. Apart from Bunny's legacy, everything goes to you, Philippa.
What?
Philippa spun round. Her eyes stared. She looked dismayed, almost frightened.
But I don't want it. Really, I don't. Oh, I'd rather not. And anyway, why? Why to me?
Perhaps, said Miss Blacklock in a peculiar voice. Because there's no one else.
But there's Patrick and Julia.
Yes, there's Patrick and Julia. The odd note in Miss Blacklock's voice was still there.
They are your relations?
Very distant ones. They have no claim on me.
But I haven't either. I don't know what you think. Oh, I don't want it.
Her gaze held more hostility than gratitude. There was something almost like fear in her manner. I know what I'm doing, Philippa. I've become fond of you. And there's the boy. You won't get very much if I should die now, but in a few weeks' time it might be different. Her eyes met Philippa's steadily.
But you're not going to die, Philippa protested.
Not if I can avoid it by taking due precautions.
Precautions?
Yes. Think it over. And don't worry any more. She left the room abruptly. Philippa heard her speaking to Julia in the hall. Julia entered the drawing room a few moments later. There was a slightly steely glitter in her eyes. Played your cards rather well, haven't you, Philippa? I see you're one of those quiet ones. A dark horse.
So you heard?
Yes, I heard. I rather think I was meant to hear.
What do you mean?
Owlette is no fool. Well, anyway, you're all right, Philippa. Sitting pretty, aren't you?
Oh, Julia, I didn't mean... I never meant...
Didn't you? Of course you did. You're fairly up against things, aren't you? Hard up for money. But just remember this. If anyone bumps off Aunt Letty now, you'll be suspect number one.
But I shan't be. It would be idiotic if I killed her now, when... if I waited...
So you do know about old Mrs. What's-her-name dying up in Scotland. I wondered.
Philippa, I'm beginning to believe you're a very dark horse indeed.
I don't want to do you and Patrick out of anything.
Don't you, my dear? I'm sorry, but I don't believe you.